Hey, everybody. Welcome to a bonus episode of the Pillar Podcast, the podcast that brings you great Catholic conversation each week. I'm your host and Pillar Editor-in-Chief, J.D. Flynn. And for this bonus episode, I am joined by someone I'm really excited to talk with, and I think you should be really excited to hear from, a longtime friend of mine, really someone who's been a mentor to me, and the author of a new book that I find really interesting and I'm looking forward to talking about called True Confession. So I'm joined by my friend Fran Mayer. And Fran, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. You have an interesting career, Fran, and an interesting place in the church because until recently, you've been kind of the guy behind the guy behind the guy. So people who've known you for a long time know what kind of influence you've had and what kind of career you've had. And then there's a whole generation of people who have been probably impacted by you as Catholics and not known it at all. Tell our listeners a little bit about just your background and the work you've done in the church.
Well, you and I have talked about it in the past. I mean, I started out with the idea that I was going to be the great cinema writer of the current generation. You know,
right.
I'm a boomer. And I did that for about 6 years and made a living at it. I was a full member of Writers Guild of America West, which is a big deal, or was a big deal at that time, because it was really the union of the screenwriters in Hollywood, and it was a lot of fun. But it's not a very friendly environment for anyone with a family or anyone with any sustained religious faith. I mean, there are exceptions, obviously, but it just wasn't a good environment.
Yeah.
So after about 6 years, I decided instead of being the great cinema writer, I'd be the great novelist, and decided that writing a couple chapters of a book, a novel, and selling it, which I did, would be a great idea. Except I discovered you can't live for very long on $3,000 when you've got four people to support. So yeah. I went to work part time as an editor, copy editor for the National Catholic Register. Was editor-in-chief 6 months later, and did that for 15 years, got recruited for the Archdiocese of Denver as communications chief, and then as chancellor and special assistant to Archbishop Chaput when he came to Denver in 1997. And basically, I did that for the rest of my diocesan career. Yeah. It was 23 years.
And I've talked on this show before about kind of having been formed in the what I think of as the Chaput paradigm, a particular approach to church leadership, which emphasizes like lay apostolate outside the institutional structures of the church, but also can have a place for lay people in church leadership sort of structurally as well. And the way in which I found Chaput to be just very consultative and formational for the people who worked with him. And, you know, there are people who we know, like Jonathan Reyes at the Knights of Columbus and Tim Gray at the Augusta, lots of people who we know who sort of been formed in one way or another by that paradigm. But you're unique, Fran, because you, I suspect, played a more central role in actually developing that model and paradigm than those of us who benefited from it.
Yeah, well, for whatever reason, we just, our thought coincided. It was very easy to work for Archbishop Chaput because what he represented and what he thought were precisely what I believed in. And so, you know, JD, you faced this yourself. I mean, the when you're in that kind of a position, you can take one of two courses. You can become a public intellectual, and George Weigel, people like that have done that very well. Or you can decide to be invisible and be effective in another way.
Yeah.
And it always struck me, I guess it was the experience of having been the boss for 15 years at the National Catholic Register. I didn't need that anymore.
Yeah.
So it just was very, very fruitful being able to contribute to Archbishop Chaput's ministry. And he was terrific as a, you remember this, I mean, he was terrific as a boss in welcoming good advice from good people. And he knew how to recruit very well. And so it created a very, very fertile environment of lay counsel to the clergy in Denver and in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that, I mean, working for Archbishop Chaput, having him as my first boss was like, I've said on this show a lot, really the best thing that could have happened to me in terms of wanting to serve the church. Now, mm-hmm. You decided to become invisible. I've decided to become a menace or a gadfly. So that's a different path. But
both needed, unfortunately.
You chose more wisely, probably. One thing, Fran, that I've been struck by is, yeah, you had this decades-long career in the institutional structure of the church after the Register, and yet you don't exhibit, you know, what Pope Francis talks about, the kind of clericalization of the laity. There are lines or distinctions that I suspect you've drawn in terms of the kinds of things you get involved in and the kinds of things you don't. and the ways in which you relate to clergy, even the archbishop, and the ways you don't. What have you done to sort of, over a long ecclesiastical career, avoid becoming an ecclesiastic, so to speak?
Yeah, I've never believed in equality in a secular sense. I mean, obviously, equality under the law, equality of voting rights, things like that are very, very important in this kind of a country and culture. But it doesn't reflect real life. We're not equal, in fact. God creates us to be dependent on one another and to have different tasks. And so the church has always struck me as being thoroughly sane in dividing up the tasks of evangelization, administration of the community of faith. And I considered, like a lot of guys my age, considered very seriously for years entering the seminary and decided that wasn't for me. Which is very good for the church, by the way, because I would have made a bad cleric. But, I don't want to be a priest. I don't want to be a deacon. Yeah. I want to be a lay person and live in the world and try to witness my life with my family as believers in Jesus Christ. And I think that's a good thing. And, you know, I think to get back to the genius of Archbishop Chaput's leadership, I think he was sympathetic, JD, to guys like us because he came from a Reform community. I mean, the Capuchins were a Reform movement, which within the Franciscan community, which itself was a Reform movement. And he says actually in the introduction to the book that the Franciscans were originally a lay vocation, not a clerical one. You know, and he wanted to be a Capuchin before he wanted to be a priest. So he was he had a really keen sense of the dignity of the lay vocation without in any way diminishing the dignity of the priesthood. And that was really liberating for me because I could contribute and I didn't have to be something I wasn't. And I wish more bishops actually had that kind of a spirit.
Yeah, it seems to me actually to be the kind of consultative approach that we hear a lot of talk about now, but we don't often see in practice. I mean, people who are most critical of sort of clericalism in the church are themselves the most clericalist. And so I think that's really important, that model of leadership, as I said, has been formational for me. But before we talk about the book, I do wonder, in that long career, you know, you talk about it with a lot of humility and the sense of not believing in equality. But I know a lot of our listeners work in the church. That's why I'm asking about this. Either they're priests who work in the chancery or they're lay people who work in a parish or chancery. Were there times, Fran, where you sort of thought, man, if I were the archbishop, I would X, Y, and Z and things would be a lot better than how they're going to play out?
No, I always thought that if I were the bishop, I would screw things up because I live a lot of my brain, you know. I mean, I'm a cerebral type person, and that's not a very good pastoral way of approaching people. Mm. You have to be more balanced. And I always thought Chaput was a perfect balance of a really smart intellect, disciplined to be fundamentally pastoral in his approach. And I don't have that skill. Mm. I mean, I'm a really good advisor. And at the Register, I thought I was a pretty good editor, but those are skills that are different from listening to people who are alienated and miserable and just want to criticize. I mean, I don't have a lot of patience with that. I would have made a bad bishop.
I'll tell you a story. You over our time in the Archdiocese of Denver, became a really good friend and to Kate and I. And I I've sort of always looked up to you professionally. When I first got to Denver and I sort of figured out who you were, I approached you. I don't know if you remember this, but I approached you because I wanted to sort of ask, how can I sort of learn from Fran? You know what I mean? So I came to you and I said, hey, could I take you to lunch? I just like to learn about things. And you said, oh, I'm very busy. I rarely eat lunch. And then you went right back to your desk. And I thought, okay, lesson one, this guy doesn't cotton to a lot of bullshit.
Yeah, no, I don't remember that, but it sounds like me at a certain point in my life.
it was a good lesson for me.
Yeah. You know, look, I found that when you're under the radar, you can really get a lot of cool stuff done.
Yeah.
And that was very much the way that I don't know how carefully I thought that through at the beginning, because I stuck around after Chaput came. I mean, I originally got recruited to serve Archbishop Stafford, who was a really good guy, but a very different personality. Yeah. And when Chaput was announced, I thought, well, that's that, you know, go find another job. And I remember vividly the first personal conversation I had with him was, you don't want to be the communications chief, you want to be my chancellor. So, I mean, the guy was absolutely decisive.
Yeah.
And he had a very strong evangelical streak, which I admired. That's what he was all about, you know, preaching the word.
And when he told you that, did you know, I mean, the notion of chancellor plays out very differently in different places. You became effectively a consigliere. Did you even know that was a role?
Yeah. No, I knew what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very shrewd that he gave me that title. Of course, you know, you're a canonist, you know that under the code, lay people can be chancellors, you know. But you, as vice chancellor, ended up doing all the work of chancellor.
All the canon law stuff. Yeah, that's right.
And basically, it was a title that people on the outside of the church would say, whoa, chancellor.
Yeah, it sounds, you can do things on behalf of the archbishop because it sounds like you'd have a big Thomas More chain or some other stuff like that, right? Yeah.
The only canonical thing I did was co-sign his documents, his official documents, you know. But the substance of the job was what you said, consigliere, special assistant. And basically, I did the same job for 23 years, you know. And it became easier and a lot more fruitful as the time went on, because you kind of get into the groove of your boss's thinking. It's easy to, you know, to think like him and to research in appropriate ways for him and all that. And so it worked out really nicely.
So, Fran, you spent those two decades with Archbishop Chaput, a little more than that, and then, you know, he retired in 2020, and, you're in a new phase of your career. You've been writing more with your own, you know, writing more, being more public about your own views on things. And then you did something which really surprised me, because here's a guy, you know, at the tail end of his career, who's had a front row seat to a lot of things in the life of the church and learned from one of the greats, and you wrote a book about what other people think.
Yeah.
What was that decision?
Well, you know, when you finish a career, you think, well, I'm going to write the grand strategy of the Catholic Church, you know, and all that, this nonsense. You know? But the truth of the matter is that other people have done that already in various ways. You know, I'm not Rusty Reno. I'm not George Weigel. I'm not, and I'm not, you know, young and upcoming like you guys are, you and Ed. Mm-hmm. And so what do I have to offer? Well, the main thing I have to offer is that I'm a skeptical person by nature, and I entered diocesan work with the assumption that somehow I was going to have my faith challenged, and so I was only going to stay in it long enough to learn how the machine works and get out. And instead, I fell in love with it. And 23 years of diocesan service later, and then now another four working as a scholar, I love the church more than when I started. And I don't have a problem. I guess it's because Augustine has always been one of my models. I don't have a problem with people screwing things up. I mean, I assume that's going to happen. Yeah. And so when you run into that inside the institutional church, it's not a big surprise. I mean, what did I expect? I know myself. I know what I confess in confession. Yeah. Why would I expect priests to really be a great deal better than that?
Yeah.
But in fact, the environment within the dioceses that I worked was very positive. I mean, you run into ambitious guys and jerks, and just like everywhere else. But on the balance, the priests I worked with, the bishops I worked with, were just really good men. And I thought, well, I'm not sure everybody sees that from the outside looking in, and I wanted to get what they thought, you know. And then in addition, I mean, the lay people I interviewed are just a fabulous example of people who are faithful under really difficult circumstances, who love Jesus and love the church despite the burdens that they might carry or the frustrations that they might have. And people need to hear that, because there's so much garbage on the internet and in major news media about the problems in the church that we lose sight of the fact that there's also, particularly in the United States, there's an enormous amount of energy that really is a source of hope.
Yeah.
So that was my reasoning anyhow, you know.
So the framing of the book is that you talked with bishops, you talked with priests, you talked with lay people, and really across a lot of different sort of segments of the life of the church. I thought it was interesting that you talked with people who do apostolates and then the people who fund them, you know, kind of the Siemens and other people. I mean, that was neat. What sort of surprised you about, what common threads did you find that you might not have expected?
There weren't a lot of surprises other than how committed people were and how frank they were. I mean, they're very candid. A couple of things. I think I was expecting more criticism, frankly, of Francis than I heard.
I was too, especially among the bishops who seemed sort of ambivalent about him.
Yeah. The general theme of the bishops toward Francis is basically confusion about why don't you like us? Yeah. you know, that kind of thing. what's the problem? Because we're really trying hard here. The lay people, some of them are more critical, but even there's an instinctive fidelity to the Holy See in the American church that goes all the way back to when we were a mission church and Rome was the only protection that we had. So there wasn't a lot of overt hostility to Francis, and certainly not to the Holy See in general. And that, I guess I was a little bit surprised about that. There were a couple of bishops who said that, you know, who made a point of saying that they hadn't had one seminarian come to their diocese inspired by Francis as a leader, and contrasting that with Benedict XVI and John Paul II. But in general, it was, you know, a lot of fidelity, and that was a good thing. And I drew a lot of life. I'm not exactly answering your question here, but I drew a lot of energy from the fact that people felt free to say what they actually thought, mm-hmm. you know, and I really loved that because when I worked for Shapiro, and as you remember this too, he was relentless about honesty.
Yeah.
I mean, you could come back from any mistake if it was well-intended, but what you couldn't come back from was lying. Mm-hmm. You lied to him and you were in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And that was because he was really committed to honesty. And if you compare that to, you know, you'll know the truth and the truth will make you free from John. I mean, that's exactly the right attitude we all have to have. We can't fix problems in the church without honestly, respectfully, but honestly identifying them. Yeah. And when you hear people talk about the church out of a spirit of love, but also out of a spirit of candor, and that's what I was looking for from faithful people, you get a pretty good, you come away feeling pretty clean,
yeah,
and hopeful, because you fix an illness once you properly describe it.
Yeah. But it's interesting that you say that, because it seems to me that there are a few ways in which Catholics are often encouraged, people in the life of the church are often encouraged against honesty. One is, now I think a lot of people just struggle with how to talk about the Pope. They want to talk about their own experience of the Pope, their own confusion about the Pope, but there's often a sense, especially for clerics, that doing so would not only be disloyal, but also could have real consequences. I mean, kind of the Bishop of Puerto Rico who was bounced out and these kinds of things. But also, it seems sometimes we really want to be honest about other ecclesiastical tribes, but we don't want to be as honest or willing to look at the challenges or the deficiencies in our own kind of ecclesiastical tribe. How did that kind of play out, do you think, both of those things?
Well, when you say tribe, are you talking about internal tribes within the Catholic Church or the Catholic Church as a tribe versus?
No, internal tribes within the Catholic Church, progressive Catholics who are very keen to sort of pick on conservative apostolates, but, you know, won't see the planks in their own eyes. And then vice versa, sort of conservative JP2-ish Catholics who are keen to sort of fire shots at the National Catholic Reporter, but don't want to take a hard look at their own realities.
Well, I think, first of all, that's a bad thing. Obviously, saying that doesn't do any good, though, because people are instinctively familial and tribal in their loyalties. I think the most important thing is that a lot of Catholics identify with a certain version of the church rather than with the person of Jesus Christ and the church secondarily. You know, I think that's the heart of the matter. The progressive versus conservative struggles within the church are frequently legitimate because they have to do with genuine theological issues that have long-term consequences. But it's very easy for those things to spill over into institutional machinery issues, you know, that we want to do it this way rather than that way. And then all of a sudden, you're not really talking about Jesus Christ anymore. You're talking about institutional power.
Yeah.
And that's where everything starts to go off the rails. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm angry all the time, you know, or why so many people are angry all the time, is that there's just never any tranquility in an institution that's supposed to provide that piece of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I've said this many times before in private conversation and also, in interviews, I have a problem with anger. Anyway, that's just my core problem, which Sue Ann is happy to remind me about all the time, you know. But in addition to that, there's lots to be angry about. Yeah. And it's constantly being fueled by other people who are upset about something and then put it on the internet and that gets answered and it's just a constant gunfight.
Yeah.
You can't build a culture and you certainly can't build a peaceful religious community with that kind of conflict.
Fran, I have a problem with being a persistently kind of a smart about things. And in the same way as you feel there's a lot to be angry about, I think, but there's just so much to mock. You know what I mean? There's so much to be a smart at. Because I think to go to the point that you made before, you know, we should expect that in a religion where the fundamental premise is we're sinners, that we'll only do things so well. But I like what you say about that a lot of sort of inter-ecclesial warfare comes down to a focus on institutional machinery instead of the Lord.
Yeah.
And did you see that in the people you spoke with? Did you see an awareness of that? Did the people you spoke with strike you as being primarily disciples and moving past that?
Yeah. Well, yes, I did actually. And that was one of the things you asked me what surprised me was that there was actually very little of that tribalism and a big effort to focus on what was essential and redemptive about the church.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was really struck. Well, first of all of the all the lay people I talked with were tremendously encouraging. But the women I talked with when they were talking specifically about the church were especially articulate. Mm. A real feminine love for the church that was quite moving in some cases. And I'm not diminishing the guys that I spoke with because the male scholars I spoke with were also really, really smart and insightful. But yeah, it's just we see things instinctively. We see things darker than they actually are. Mm-hmm. And for Christians, that's just really weird when you step back and think, wait a minute, we've already won this thing,
right.
You know?
Right.
So how come we're not acting that way?
Yeah. Fran, I'm interested in a kind of another set of differences that I wonder how you came away from the book with. I think there's a shift among practicing Catholics and practicing faithful Catholics who hold the teachings of the church, sort of in generational mindsets that, and this, there are a lot of elements to this, but you know, I'm 40, I don't know, so 40 something, 41, you're probably 30 years, you've probably got 30 years on me.
Oh, better than that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And while I think, you know, both of us would hold to the teachings of the church, probably my contemporaries would have much less sort of trust in the institution of the church, much less trust in the institution of America, be far more critical of sort of the American experiment. And they're probably be far more impacted by 2018 and McCarrick, or at least differently impacted by 2018 and McCarrick. What were some of the generational differences that you saw as you talked with people?
Well, I think there's a real hunger among younger people, particularly young families, for tradition.
Yeah.
You see that in the attachment of a lot of younger families to the Latin Mass. And it's not nostalgia. It's not nostalgia. And it's not right-wing politics. It's a desire for beauty and grounding in something stable that's connected to the past. So I think in that sense, Rome has really profoundly misread a lot of the loyalty to the Latin Mass. And it was, I think, very unwise to move so aggressively against it, because all it really did was alienate people who otherwise could be won over. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's one thing. I mean, the whole world of sex is completely different in terms of the issues that I faced and the issues that young people face now. You know, I mean, I lived through the 60s as a college student, and even when I didn't behave, let's put it this way, even when I didn't behave in a Catholic manner, I had the formation and the knowledge of the Catholic tradition, which was very, very important in my family. You know, so that I had a lot of gas in the gas tank, made it easy to come back to. I think young people today don't have that anymore because it's been shattered by not just the liberation of sex from permanent relationships, but just the weird direction it's taken in terms of transgender stuff and the explosion of LGBT issues and things like that. I didn't have to deal with that. And I also didn't have to deal with the idea of permanence. You know, when I met Sue, I thought, okay, she's the one. and I'm all in, and that's it. Yeah. You know, permanence wasn't scary to me. I think it is really frightening to a lot of young people now.
I've been surprised by the way in which that divide exhibits among orthodox prelates of your generation. I think especially you point out the Latin Mass thing, don't always understand what it is that's attractive to it about people, even especially younger than I am. Do you see more bishops coming to understand why young people are attracted to liturgical traditionalism?
Oh, yes. And I heard that from bishops. Some of it's recorded in the book. I mean, bishops who expected to find a bunch of old nostalgic people at the masses and found young families that were not kind of crackpot right-wingers, but just trying to bring their kids up in an environment of beauty. I'm not diminishing the fact that in some countries and in some places in this country, the Latin Mass is a resistance exercise. You know, we don't like Rome. We hate Rome. We don't like the Pope. And so we're going to do this. But I think that's a minority.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just this huge desire to remember who we are. You know, Americans are lousy at history. We always have been because we're a novus ordo seclorum, a new order of things, you know. So we always don't like the past because dragging it around it prevents us from reinventing ourselves. But for Catholics, that's utterly deadly because, like the Jews, we are who our parents and grandparents and great parents were. I mean, we're part of a long-term narrative that we need to insert ourselves into. And so remembering our history, revering it, not letting it dictate the future, but letting it inform and influence the future becomes really, really important. And my generation, the boomers, basically dumped it overboard. And now we're adrift with no kind of guidance from past experience. And recovering our history is really critical because for two reasons that I've said many times. One of them is a good lesson in humility because we have this amazing talent at screwing things up. And we do it routinely. But the other thing, too, is that God always provides the saints to heal that. And that's also the story of history. The reason you and I are talking right now is because, you know, saints were raised up to fix problems that have recurred throughout the history of the church. You know, the Arian heresy, the rise of Islam, the Reformation. You know, reading a history of the 125 years before the Reformation is a really good exercise. Because it's impossible to imagine things getting more screwed up than that century, you know.
Yeah.
But here we are, you know.
The consolation of history, as Newman talks about it. So what do you think, along with the sort of rejection of traditionalism, which we can sort of put in liturgy and probably family life and things like that, we're just at a really interesting political moment for Catholics where, you know, I think many young and practicing Catholics have largely rejected the sort of political compromises of Orthodox Catholic boomers and said, no, we don't sort of want to be neocons 2.0. And we don't think that that worked especially well. And, you know, at the same time, you just see sort of a complete remaking of the Republican Party and in a very different paradigm. So you have all these sort of emerging factions, the sort of post-liberal people and integralist people and sort of a little bit of Christian democracy thrown in. But where do you see, or what did you see among the Catholics who you spoke with about the trends for political identity or political activity among practicing Catholics?
Yeah, I think there's a real skepticism toward over-attaching ourselves to the American experiment. You know, even from people who are otherwise quite politically conservative. I mean, I think Catholics need to understand that what is it from Philippians? You know, we have no lasting city or this isn't. Anyway, the point is this isn't our home.
We can't be expected to know the Bible, friend. This is a Catholic podcast. Don't worry, we're fine.
Yeah. Well, I may have gotten it wrong anyway, but our first citizenship is heaven. And we need to reconnect to that in an important way. So, I mean, do I love the United States? Yeah, I do in an appropriate way because patriotism properly understood is a version of the fourth commandment. But I'm obligated to love the best ideals. I'm not obligated to the actual reality that we have on the ground, love the actual reality we have on the ground. And what we have on the ground is not very good right now. and it's going in the wrong direction, because the biblical side of this mixed marriage between the Enlightenment and a kind of a Protestant past is breaking down, and the religion is going out the door. And so we've got a culture now that is still has a veneer of biblical faith, but it really its substance is completely secular. And I'd take it a step further, JD, in that we're the most materialist culture in human history, and that has a catechetical effect on every new life that comes into it. And so we really, as a believing community, we need to spend a lot more time detaching ourselves mentally and spiritually from the loyalty that we have to the United States as a political entity. I don't mean disengaging politically, because we're not allowed to do that. We have to be engaged in trying to be leaven in society. We have to be much, much more skeptical toward the United States in terms of, what it claims to be and what it actually is. I think that's the most important advice I'd give to people, beyond recovering a sense of authentic Catholic history, detaching ourselves from an excessive love of the American experiment as a political thing is a very important step.
Is that viewpoint or an evolution of thought for you? I mean, that's very different language from the language of the USCCB's Fortnight for Freedom and sort of the marriage of the hierarchical constitution of the church to partisanship, in previous decades. Do you feel like you've had an evolution on that front?
Well, the evolution is simply observing what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an evolution in the sense that, I think I've mentioned this to you before, JD, when our oldest son made it into West Point in the early 90s, I mean, Sue and I were over the moon. I mean, we thought this is really great. It's a huge honor, blah, blah, blah. I would never encourage a kid to do that now. I mean, I wouldn't stop them, because other people have different views from me that are just as authentic as mine. But why would I want one of my kids to die for the right to have an illicit sexual relationship or an abortion?
Right.
I mean, that's just crazy. I don't want that. I don't fight for that. I don't believe that. I'm not going to, risk my life or my children's life in supporting that idea of freedom, which is completely defective.
Yeah.
So it's evolved in that sense. Yeah.
Let me ask you, I want to come back to the book a little bit. But I want to note something that seemed to me to be a bit of a lacuna in the book, and maybe it's just what people were and weren't talking about. So you tell me, but I was surprised that more people weren't talking about post-McCarrick institutional reform. Was that on the radar for many of the people you interviewed? Were there bishops who were talking about that? Or do you think that was came and went, relatively quickly?
They had already kind of incorporated that into, okay, this is the way it was, now we have to do better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny. That's what we said after 2002 as well. I think there's a desire to put that in the rearview mirror that is understandable and is not always accurate, but I think is.
Yeah, and I think we underestimate the long-term damage that it did to the church's credibility.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a fact.
Yeah. What did you see, Fran, as you talked with people about obviously institutional disaffiliation is the story of the day, the declining, Archbishop Chaput at the end says the things he worries about are declining numbers of mass goers and a correspondent decline in vocations. Where did you see sort of evangelical fruitfulness in the church as you talked with people, or where did they see it?
Well, all the bishops, and I don't think this was just sort of imagining reality. I think it was actual reality in the dioceses. They were all pretty practical in terms of having a lot of consolation in the energy of young Catholics who are involved in their dioceses. There are fewer of them, but the ones that are there are pretty motivated. And then, the organizations that I kind of gave a nod to are all examples of young people doing really good apostolic work. I could have gone on there for a very long time. I think I picked out six of them.
Yeah.
In terms of the lay people who talked about the future, I mean, again, there's this confidence that there are fewer young people who are committed, but the ones who are committed are really committed in a way that, for example, in my generation, they weren't.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't anything at stake. It was just part of, the church was part of the furniture.
Yeah.
She isn't anymore. Now you have to make a conscious choice.
Yeah.
And it produces a different personality.
Well, thanks so much for this conversation. I'm really grateful for it. Are there any other points of the book that you would want to point to or discuss a little bit? I want to give you some room for that too.
No, I think that where did the title come from? I think people need to know that because some people look at it and think, oh, there's going to be a whole lot of dirt here. Yeah. True Confessions comes from my screenwriting days because that movie, which is based on the crime novel, True Confessions, is just a wonderfully Catholic movie and not a, it's pretty harsh toward the institution, but a really deeply Catholic story, great movie with Robert Duvall and Robert De Niro. But also it captures the, you know, Augustine's talk about his confessions. That was on my mind when I was writing it. And finally, everyone that I chose to interview for the book is confessing Jesus Christ in one way or another. Yeah. That's the reason the title stuck for me, is that we're all supposed to be confessors of our faith. And these are the people that I interviewed were people who, from all different walks of life, were just committed confessors of Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith. Yeah. And they weren't nuts. They weren't dissidents. They were just faithful, ordinary people doing good stuff. And when you do that, when you talk to them, you can't be depressed. I mean, we face a lot of very sobering problems. And there's a lot of candor in the book about those problems. But the fact of the matter is that these people still deeply believe and conform their lives to that belief. And that's a source of a lot of hope for the future, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Fantastic. Well, thanks. We're not going to end on that note because, Fran, on this podcast, we play a lot of games. So it's generally the case that if you come on this show, you have to play a game. And,
sure.
And so I'd like you to play a game. So this book, which I hope everybody will read, I'm not just saying that because I'm in it, although I am. I'm saying it because I thought it was a really good snapshot of the life of the church in the United States. True Confessions by Fran Mayer. You should get it. It's a great book. But Fran, it's a great snapshot of the life of the church in the United States right now. So we're going to play a sort of contemporary snapshot, yes or no. The way this game works is I'm just going to say something and then you're not going to filter yourself. You're not going to sort of think about the right answer. You're just going to give your instinctive, immediate, sort of visceral reaction to the thing with no qualifications. And I suspect you're going to find that that's really hard because I find it to be terrifically difficult. But here we go. Snapshot of the life of the church in the United States. Yes or no with Fran Mayer. Fran, On Eagle's Wings, the hymn.
No.
Good. See, that decisiveness is what this show, what this demands. So well done.
No, we focus on Beagle's Wings whenever we hear it. You know what I mean?
Okay. Fran, Life Teen.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Michael Voris.
No.
Okay. I hope you're going to know what I mean by this. I think you probably will. But if you don't, let me know and I can clarify. But World Youth Day Vestments.
Depends. I'm going to be neutral on that because whether they're good or not.
Have they ever been good?
I've heard rumors that every once in a while they are. Look, in 1993, everybody was so absorbed with World Youth Day in Colorado that they didn't really pay much attention, you know.
Yeah.
But I would be nervous about answering that because I suspect the answer would be a no, but I don't want to.
I've been trying to get – I want to tell you this about World Youth Day in 1993 because you might be able to help me actually. So some car dealer, and I can't remember who, donated some pickup trucks which were converted into boatmobiles for John Paul II. And as far as I can tell, the Archdiocese of Denver still owns them. So I've been calling everybody I can think of to say, tell me where the car is because I'd like to sort of go take some pictures of it in an old garage or figure out where it is and write a little feature about it. Fran, what happened to the cars at the end of World Youth Day?
I don't know. And it's really an interesting question because I think at some point early in his tenure, Archbishop Chaput had that question.
Oh,
or maybe
really?
I'm confusing it with Philadelphia. I might be confusing it with Philadelphia, but no, I don't know what happened to them. They disappeared into the, you know, mountains or something.
Do you think that Archbishop Chaput was looking for them because he wanted to turn them into Archbishop mobiles as opposed to boatmobiles? I mean, is that the...
No, I don't think that kind of personal vanity ever occurred to Chaput.
Okay.
No, I think he, you know, one of the things about Archbishop Chaput is he really hated that kind of frou-frouism. He was very, you know this, he was very, very careful about matters of liturgy an appropriate respect for office. Other than that, he was not a formalistic kind of a person.
Well, our friend Deacon Chuck Parker, who was at our time the director of liturgy here, was always trying to get Archbishop Chaput to wear the purple socks that befit a bishop. And he was having none of it. And I think Chuck told him that his plan is to bury him in those socks, whether he likes it or not. But Archbishop Chaput would have nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I've got another story for you. We came back from celebrating Mass one day at one of the convents one of the convents in the diocese. And I asked him how it went, and the nuns had provided him with vestments, and he said, "Well, he dressed me up like the Infant of Prague." he was an essentialist. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Okay. This next one you've got to be honest about. It's really important to tell the truth on this show. The Pillar.
Liv Taylor.
The Pillar.
Oh, the Pillar. I love it.
Oh, great.
No, that's an absolutely true statement.
Now I'll ask Liv Taylor.
I thought Liv Taylor.
That's a very different show, Fran.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah. No, the Pillar. No, I mean, the Pillar is what I love about the Pillar, and this is sincere, I don't know that any other place gives the kind of in-depth coverage that you guys do. And I mean that sincerely. Well, I mean, there are other places, there are other good places to get Catholic information, but I don't think anything does it as well as the Pillar right now. So that's an honest compliment.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. Sister Wilhelmina, she's the incorrupt nun of Missouri.
Yes.
Peter's Pence, yes or no?
No.
As a hymn, as a liturgical hymn, the battle hymn of the Republic.
So as a liturgical hymn?
Yeah,
no.
You hear it around patriotic holidays.
No.
Okay. Fair enough. Christian rock.
No.
Diaconesses.
No.
The neo-catechumenal way.
Yes.
This is one I don't know how you're going to... I've predicted most of these so far, but I don't know where you're going to go with this one. Ad Orientem.
Yes, but that's not as...
It sounds like a qualified yes.
It is a qualified yes, yeah, because I wouldn't want to, institutionalize that. I think it's got a lot of beauty, but no, not to make that the mandate or the rule.
Okay. This one I think I can predict. Roger Cardinal Mahony. He doesn't want to answer. He doesn't want to answer, everybody.
Yeah. No.
St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
And finally, because I know it's your alma mater, the University of Notre Dame.
Modified yes.
A modified yes.
Yes.
Notre Dame's probably a great overall snapshot of Catholic America, isn't it? There's
yes,
great
it is.
Things going on and things that don't make any sense at all.
Yeah, really. That's absolutely true. I mean, there are women and men there that are absolutely first-rate Catholic scholars. And then there's the other Notre Dame, which is messed up.
Yeah, and there's sort of this interesting interplay between the two. And yeah, I think you're right about that. Well, Fran, thanks so much for playing Contemporary Snapshot of the Church, Yes or No. The book is True Confessions by Fran Mayer, published by Ignatius Press. You should get it because I thought it was really interesting. And the Pillar Podcast is a production of Pillar Media and Ed and JD Production. Our executive producer is Kate Oliveira. I'm your host, JD Flynn, and my guest was Fran Mayer. Thanks so much, Fran.
Thanks, JD. God bless.